The Tower of Edar.
The Book of Isaac is one of the longest books contained in the Book of Genesis. It goes all the way from chapter 25, verse 19, through chapter 35, and includes the history of both Isaac and Jacob. Our theme text on the Tower of Edar comes from the closing portion of this segment. It's in chapter 35 of Genesis, and we're going to read verses 15 to 21. 15 to 21 of Genesis chapter 35. And Jacob called the name of the place where God spake with him, Bethel. And they journeyed from Bethel, and there was but a little way to come to Ephrath. And Rachel travailed, and she had hard labor. And it came to pass, when she was in hard labor, that the midwife said to her, Fear not, thou shalt have this son also. And it came to pass, as her soul was in departing, for she died, that she called his name Benoni, but his father called him Benjamin. And Rachel died, and was buried in the way to Ephrath, which is Bethlehem. And Jacob set a pillar upon her grave, that is the pillar of Rachel's grave unto this day. And Israel journeyed and spread his tent beyond the Tower of Edar. It's one of those small passages of history that in itself seems to have little to offer us, other than we find here a sequence of really three events. We find the sequence of the birth of the last son of Jacob, Benjamin, the death of Rachel, and then, as far as the book of Isaac is concerned, the final dwelling place of Jacob at the Tower of Edar. But minor as this section of history is, it forms the basis, the historical basis, for one of the better known prophecies in the Bible. And it's that prophecy we're going to study together, not the history. This history is to give us a background, and only in the sequence of events, a background for the study of this prophecy, which is found in the book of Micah. And that's where our study really takes place. The book of Micah, chapters 4 and 5. Whenever we take any prophecy and begin in the middle, it's good to ascertain where we are in the scope of the prophecy. The book of Micah is divided into four sections. The first three chapters are a prophecy of the punishment of Israel. Chapters 4 and 5, the section we're going to study together, is the restoration of Israel. Chapter 6 through chapter 7, verse 10, is a second prophecy of the punishment of Israel. And chapter 7, 11, through the end of the book, is another prophecy of the restoration of Israel. So it's alternating punishment, restoration, different aspects of the two. The section we're looking at is the section dealing with the restoration of Israel. The first part of it is very familiar. You'll also find it in Isaiah chapter 2. In the last days it shall come to pass that the mountain of the house of the Lord shall be established in the top of the mountains, and it shall be exalted above the hills, and people shall flow unto it. And many nations shall come and say, Come and let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, and to the house of the God of Jacob. He will teach us of his ways, and we will walk in his paths. For the law shall go forth of Zion, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. And he shall judge among many people, and rebuke strong nations afar off. And they shall beat their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up a sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more. But they shall sit every man under his vine and under his fig tree. And none shall make them afraid, for the mouth of the Lord of hosts has spoken it. For all the people will walk every one in the name of his God, and we will walk in the name of the Lord our God forever. We would like to suggest, and in mentioning this, we mention that all we're doing is suggesting, because whenever we deal with prophecy, it's wise to remember that we cannot speak authoritatively, but only suggestively. We would like to suggest that the secret in going through this section of Micah is rightly dividing the word of truth. That there is a divisional process that is throughout this prophecy in Micah. It's set into two columns. Put these columns on the board. You've got one column called Zion, and you've got another column called Jerusalem. Without spending much time laying the foundation of these two columns, we are going to suggest something that probably most of you have already arrived at the conclusion from your studies of the volumes, and that is these two columns refer to the two salvations, the heavenly and the earthly. That Zion is a term that frequently, not always, but frequently in prophecy, relates to the heavenly salvation. And particularly when Zion and Jerusalem are together, Jerusalem frequently relates to the earthly salvation, particularly the leadership of that salvation, the ancient worthies, in their part as the princes over Israel and among many nations. In that relation, in these verses, it has been often noticed that from Zion we have the law, and from Jerusalem we have the word of the Lord. In other words, the law itself originates. The lawmakers are in the spiritual phase of the kingdom. The law proclaimers, the ones who disperse this law among the peoples, are in the natural phase of the kingdom. They're upon the earthly phase of the kingdom, and again, particularly in the ancient worthies, but also amongst the nation of Israel. And that is basically an exceeded thought, I think, among most Bible students. They see to that point. Now, we want to notice this principle as we go beyond this. We're not going to spend more time in this section other than to use this as an introduction as we come into the restoration of Israel. Verses 6 and 7. In that day, saith the Lord, will I assemble her that halteth, and I will gather her that is driven out, and take the next and put even her that I have afflicted, and I will make her that halted a remnant, and her that was cast off a strong nation, and the Lord shall reign over him in Mount Zion from henceforth, even forever. There are two reasons why we change that word and to even. Well, really three. One is you're justified in doing it. The same word means and even in the Hebrew and in the Greek. So you can do it. It depends on context. The two things in context that make us do it is in verse 6, only the halteth and her that are driven out are preceded by the verb. I will assemble her that halteth, I will gather her that is driven out, and her. So it ties the two together under one verb, suggesting that it is the same people that's involved. And the second reason, when he reiterates it in verse 7, he only has two. So therefore we think it is justified in noticing there are two things that are involved. The verb is a little different, it's very similar. There are, at the time of the restoration of Israel, two gatherings that take place. That's a true fact. You've noticed in your study the third volume particularly. There is the harvest of the true church. At the same time, there is the regathering of the dispersed of Israel from all nations. There are two simultaneous gatherings. However, here he does not use the word gathering for the one, but assembling, which is like taking parts that have been gathered and putting them into a whole. Reassembling them or assembling them. And we would suggest that the ones that are halting here, or lame, are the ones that were considered by Israel back at the first advent to be lame. The publicans, the sinners, the Gentiles, those who became the Christian church. This point in the harvest, and we're going to notice this is an advanced point in the harvest, most of these have already been gathered. They have been raised from the dead. But they have not yet been assembled into the bride of Christ. So we have under the Zion, him that halts. But at the first advent, when the Lord turned to the halting ones, turned to the lame, turned to those who were considered to be the morally sick, and chose them to be the bride of Christ, he had to do something else with the Jews who already were in his favor. And he did. He cast them off. He cast them off for a time, and that's what he says. He will regather the cast-off ones. So we have in Jerusalem the cast-off. And we just notice that he is continuing his parallelism. That at the time of the restoration of the one class, there is also a gathering or assemblage of the spiritual class. And now we come to our basic text, verse 8. And thou, O tower of the flock, the stronghold of the daughter of Zion, unto thee shall it come, even the first dominion the kingdom shall come to the daughter of Jerusalem. Now, we'd like to call a few things to your attention here. We'd like to call to your attention that the word flock, tower of the flock, is obviously not in Hebrew the word flock. It's the word from which is translated flock. It means flock. But I want to suggest we don't translate it. I want to suggest we take it just as it is in the Hebrew. Unto thee shall it come, and thou, O tower of Edar. The same word we had back there in Genesis, the Tower of Edar. That, I think, we're going to notice as we get into this when we see more similarities between the Genesis account and the Micah account. It is the symbology he's building on. He says, Tower of Edar, the stronghold of the daughter of Zion. The word stronghold is interesting here. Very seldom is this word translated. Usually, this word is left untranslated. It's the word Ophel, O-P-H-E-L. It is a geographical name of the city of David. It was the name of Mount Zion of David's time, but it wasn't the whole mountain as you would see it today. Probably most of you have seen pictures that have been taken from the Mount of Olives, the city of Jerusalem. And you see that gold dome there in front of you, the Mosque of Omar, and you look and say, that's Jerusalem. Not really. That is the walled city of Old Jerusalem, but that is not the Jerusalem of David's day. Look to the left of that same picture, and you see a ridge going down. That's Ophel. That's the Ophel Ridge. That was the city of Jerusalem in David's day, the part that is today not in the walls of the city of Zion. So he's taking two things here, two different symbols. The Tower of Edar was not in Jerusalem. It was, as the name suggests, a tower of flocks. We would call it a migdal, a watchtower, out in the field. That's where Jacob dwelt. But he uses one symbol, and then he says, this symbol is like another symbol. But it's not like the other symbol. It's very diverse. One is rural, the other is urban. One is out in the field, the other is in the capital city of Jerusalem. He's using two diverse symbols that he is saying, you are both. You are both the Tower of Edar, and you are the Ophel. He is to different classes each. He is to Jerusalem, the Tower of Edar, and he is to Zion, the Ophel, the city of David. He is now showing that in this regathering, on the one hand of natural Israel, on the other hand, of spiritual Israel, there are different destinations involved. And these different destinations have similarities, but they have dissimilarities. The one is pastoral, the other is governmental. The one deals with the head of the state, the government, the other deals with the pastor. But there was a similarity that we haven't mentioned. There was a Tower of Ophel. That's well, long gone out of existence. But as you would come up the Ophel Ridge, right at the point where the gate goes now into the city, and went at that time into the temple area, that was called the Temple Mount, there was a gate tower that was there that was called the Tower of Ophel. And that was there at the time this was written. It says, to the church, Christ is going to be the entrance into that temple. He is going to be that gateway. To natural Israel, he's also a tower. He's that tower that was the last experience of Jacob. He is the final resting place of Jacob, the final destiny of Jacob. He is the final destiny of both. To the one class, it is whatever the work of the Tower of Edar is, and we'll notice that as we progress. To the other, it's the work of going into and ministering the temple, administering the government of the new city. To the one class, he says, unto thee shall it come, the first dominion. That goes under Zion, the first dominion. But to the other, notice, the kingdom will not go to Zion. The kingdom will go to the daughter of Jerusalem. He again distinguishes where the kingdom goes. I think we could paraphrase it this way. Unto you, daughter of Zion, shall go the dominion. But the kingdom will be administered by the daughters of Jerusalem. The one is describing where the law comes from. The other is describing where the word of the Lord comes from. He is talking about a progression, two parts working together as one whole. He's describing a unified arrangement that he is bringing together by this gathering. This first dominion is pictured by Ophel. Ophel was the capital. That was where the government went forth. But the Tower of Edar was the administration of the kingdom. That's the setting. This is what he is saying back there in Genesis when he builds this prophecy. Now there is a final dwelling place for Jacob, for the people of Jacob, the descendants of Jacob, the Jacobites, the Israelites, that is represented by the Tower of Edar of the kingdom. But how do we get there? Well, we keep on reading. And notice how this develops to this. Now, why do you cry out loud? Is there no king in thee? Is thy counselor perished? Now, knowing what your destiny is, knowing that to you is going to come this kingdom, why are you bemoaning your fate? Is there not king not in you? The king is in her. She does not recognize her king. It's a picture of a non-recognition of what will produce this Tower of Edar state, this final state of her destiny. It says, really, you can't. Because something has to transpire first. And that was the beauty of that little bit of history. Before Jacob could move to Edar, something had to happen. A child had to be born. A woman had to die. Then he could move to Edar. Before Israel can move to this state, something has to happen. A child has to be born. A woman has to die. And that's what he goes on. Why do you cry? Is there no king in you? Pangs are taking you like a woman in travail. Be in pain. Labor to come forth, O daughter of Zion, like a woman in travail. So that's the experience you must have before you can come to the status of producing this kingdom arrangement. You have to finish this period of travail. Go forth out of the city. Thou shalt dwell in the field. Thou shalt go even to Babylon. Isn't that what happened to that woman? She went even to a Babylonian captivity and had to be called out of Babylon. Revelation 18:4, come out of her, my people. Before this travail could take forth. Then you will be delivered from Babylon. There the Lord shall redeem thee from the hand of thine enemies. And that's the place where the travail produces the birth. Now it's probably wise to notice here that Rachel has two children. This is only speaking of the birth of her last child and of her death. This is speaking of the birth of Benjamin. Before that, not in the direct history, but earlier in the history, it talks about the birth of Joseph. Rachel, like Sarah, represents a covenant. In fact, the same. A covenant of sacrifice that produces two children. The little flock and the great company. And it's not until the great company is produced that this covenant ends in his death and comes to a termination point and the kingdom arrangement, the Tower of Edar state, can be arrived at. There is a progression in the order that's here. You perhaps remember that text that is so often quoted along this line in Isaiah, the 66th chapter, verses 7 to 11. And we think it's pertinent to quote it again. Before she travailed, she brought forth the man-child, her child, the church. Who hath heard of such a thing? Who hath seen such things? Shall the earth be made to bring forth in one day? Shall a nation be made to born at once? As soon as she travailed, she brought forth her multiple children, the great multitude, the great company. After the one travail, before the time of travail, before the greatness of the trouble, comes the second. Going back to our text in Micah, we talked about two gatherings. We talked about the gathering of natural Israel and the gathering of spiritual Israel. concurrently with these two gatherings, there is a third gathering. And now he's going to talk about the third gathering in Micah to complete the picture. Now also, in addition, many nations are gathered. Now the gathering of nations is a very common element in prophecy. Revelation 16, under the sixth plague, three unclean spirits like frogs went out to gather the nations to the battle of Armageddon. Zechariah 14, verses 1 and 2, I will gather all nations against Jerusalem. Joel 3, I will gather all nations into the valley of Jehoshaphat, there to pour out my wrath upon them. The gathering of the nations to the point of their destruction is the third of the gatherings that Micah deals with. Now also, many nations are gathered against thee, that say, let her be defiled, and let our eye also look upon Zion. Let this be the hour of Israel's destruction, but at the same time, their eye is upon the true church. There is a persecution that goes, again, two ways by this third gathering. But they don't know the thoughts of the Lord. They don't understand this counsel, that he is gathering them really like sheaves of the floor. They think they're gathering against the Lord and his anointed. Well, I said, they're gathering all right, but not for the reason they think they're gathering. They don't know my will in the matter. They think they are gathering. In fact, I am gathering them to this arrangement. You know, the psychology here is a psychology that is demonstrated so well in Acts, the fourth chapter, in a first Advent prophecy of gathering of the nations. Notice Acts 4, starting in verse 25. Who by the mouth of thy servant David had said, why did the heathen rage, the people imagine vain things? The kings of the earth stood up, and the rulers were gathered. There is the word again. They were gathered together against the Lord and against his anointed. Then he applies it, back in the first Advent, of a truth, against thy holy child, Jesus, whom thou hast anointed, both Herod and Pontius Pilate with the Gentiles and the people of Israel were gathered together. They gathered to stop the Lord. But notice what he goes on to say. They were gathered together to do whatsoever my will determined before to be done. They gathered together to do my will. No, they didn't. They gathered to do their own will. It's only that their own will happened to be God's will. They did not understand the counsels of the Lord. And that's what's happening here in Micah. They have gathered against this gatherings of the Lord. But the Lord said, fine. They are gathered together. They don't understand my thought. I want them together because that way they can more conveniently burn them all at once. I've got all the sheaves together. Now I can do what verse 13 says. Arise and thresh, O daughter of Zion. I will make thine horn iron, I will make thy hoofs brass. Thou shalt beat in pieces many people, and I will consecrate their gain unto the Lord and their substance unto the Lord of the whole earth. They have gathered, fine, now we can have the harvest, and we can crush them. And he crushes all this chaff together. But there's a prophet. And he said, this prophet will be consecrated to the Lord. Now, this is another standard symbol that comes up time and time again. That there is a tremendous wealth there in the nations, in Christendom, and in the heathen nations. That's not to be melted down and poured down the drain. But the Lord says this wealth is to be devoted. Notice when Israel first went into the promised land. Remember the first city they attacked? Jericho. What did the Lord say about Jericho? Don't touch anything in that city because it's mine and it's holy unto me. It was holy, even though it was a pagan city. Isaiah is a chapter 26 or 23, the one about the 70 years in Babylon. I think that's 23. Notice verse 17 and 18. It shall come to pass after the end of 70 years that the Lord will visit Tyre, and she shall turn to her hire and commit fornication with all the kings of the world, and her merchandise and her hire shall be holiness to the Lord. It would be devoted to the Lord. Zechariah 14, same picture. I will gather all nations against Israel. And what happens? Even their pots shall be holiness unto the Lord. Everything that was there will be turned over. All the things that have been accumulated are not just to be wasted. But the Lord says, what was using these things, the way it was used, will be eliminated. The things themselves will be converted to kingdom use. These are holiness unto the Lord. And that's what he's saying here in Micah. So he gives a command to these nations. Chapter 5, verse 1. Now, therefore, gather thyself in troops. Not daughter of Zion, not daughter of Jerusalem, but daughter of troops. Now he's talking to the forces of the Lord's great army that are upon the scene. He said, gather yourself, come on down. He that hath laid siege against us, they shall smite the judge of Israel with a rod upon his cheek. Now we would suggest here that the judge of Israel is whoever is sitting in the governmental seat of Israel at the time of this invasion. That is merely saying that when they come down, whoever is the head of Israel will fall. Zechariah said the same thing. The city shall be taken. But now he goes on. He says, that judge is not the real judge. He said, they will smite the judge of Israel with a rod, but thou, Bethlehem Ephratah, though thou be little among the thousands of Judah, out of thee shall he come forth as the ruler in Israel. There is the real judge. He isn't even on the scene yet, as far as you know. He's on the scene. You haven't recognized him. But he's saying that your judge will be smitten by these invading hordes. And now this new judge comes in. But you notice, he introduces this new judge by using a First Advent prophecy. A prophecy that does not pertain to this time, goes all the way back some 2,000 years earlier. Because by this prophecy, he is identifying the reality of who that judge will be. This is the same one that back there was born in Bethlehem. We use that principle all the time in Prince of Timothy, when it says there is one God and one mediator between God and man, a second Advent, isn't it? Who gave himself a ransom. That's first. You've got the connection of the Advent. There is a connection between the two. I think one of the things I most appreciated in the last 10, 15 years in fellowship was a question I asked one brother in Poland a few years ago about the second Advent. And his answer was, well, to understand that, we have to look at the first Advent. That's so simple that the first Advent mirrors the second. There is a parallelism of dispensation. And that's all he's saying. Notice this, and you can see the reality down here. You know, it's interesting that Micah 5:2 is quoted twice. First time is quoted in Matthew, the second chapter, and is quoted by the priests to the wise men on the journey through to identify where the child would be born. And the second time is in the Gospel of John, chapter 7, verse 42, and there is quoted by the common people, wondering whether or not Jesus is the Messiah. Both times when they quote, when the people quote, or when the priests quote, they leave out a phrase. They're not honest in their quotation. And the phrase they leave out tells a lot about the feeling of the minds of the people at that time. Here's what they quoted. But thou, Bethlehem Ephratah, though thou be little among the thousands of Judah, yet out of thee shall he come forth unto me that is a ruler in Israel. Period. End of quote. What they didn't say, whose goings forth have been from of old, from everlasting. They couldn't say it. To them, that was blasphemy. That was their charge against it. They were willing to admit their deliverer would come from Israel, from Bethlehem. But they were not willing to admit that their deliverer had been the Son of God. That their deliverer had been from way back. Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God is one God. And it's not Jehovah. They weren't Trinitarians. But on the other hand, they couldn't accept the thought of the Son of God. That was beyond their comprehension. And so they left off that part of the quote. They quoted that which was pertinent to their point. They left off that which was beyond the point that they were willing to admit. Now, we've suggested, but haven't yet really shown and demonstrated, that this prophecy of the first Advent belongs at the first and the rest belongs to the second. Because that seems like an odd statement to take one segment and say, well, that's a flashback. But that's what he says in the next verse. Therefore will he give them up until the time that she which travailed has brought forth. And right there you have the time delay put in. He said, yes, your king came. The one who was the deliverer came from Bethlehem. Bethlehem. All the way back to what we read in Genesis 35. That's the only other place where you find Bethlehem Ephrathah, is in that story of the birth of Benjamin. Now he's saying, not only does Benjamin born there, but Jesus is born there. He who was born in Bethlehem, but that's not the point. He said, that isn't the birth we're talking about. He said, you're going to be cast off because you have not recognized this one who came out of Bethlehem Ephrathah, until she which travailed, Rachel, shall come forth with the reality that was pictured back there in Genesis 35. The spirit begotten classes of Christ in the church, of the church and the great company. When these classes produce their seed, then will be the time for this reality restoration. We've made the identification, we've given that same time lag that we see in the story. First a birth and a death, then the move to the power of Edom. First a birth and a death, and then the move of Israel to their final resting place, their kingdom position, shown by that tower of Edar. When she which travailed brought forth, then the remnant of his brethren shall return unto the children of Israel. And he shall stand and feed in the strength of the Lord, in the majesty of the name of the Lord his God, and they shall abide. For now shall he be great unto the ends of the earth. I'd like to notice the interplay here between the he and the they. You've got two different things being talked about. He's saying the remnant of Israel would return. Not the whole. The remnant, a faith group. A group that some prophecies, notably Ezekiel 21 and Isaiah 6, may suggest is as low as 10%. A remnant would return. But this remnant, he said, when they come back, would be accompanied by an individual. A he, as opposed to a they. The he here is the Tower of the Flock, because he is the return Lord. He shall stand, and he shall feed them in the strength of the Lord, in the majesty of Jehovah his God. And when he feeds them, then they're going to abide. When he is their master, when he is their shepherd, then none shall pluck them up. Then they shall stay there forever. They have arrived in their abiding position. They have arrived at Jacob's last resting place. Then they are at the Tower of Edar, when they come to this place. Then he shall be great unto the ends of the earth. When is he great? Until the ends of the earth. Jeremiah 31, 31 to 34. When none shall say, know ye the Lord, for they shall all know the Lord, from the least of them to the greatest of them. When the knowledge of the Lord shall cover the earth, in the same way and to the same magnitude as the sea covers, as the waters cover the great sea. At that point, when the travail has finished its work, this would be true. thank you. Appreciate that. Now, when they return, when the Lord begins working in their midst again, as Zechariah 14 says, when he fights as he fought in the day of old, how does he fight? Micah goes on to tell us. Not only would this one stand and feed in the strength of the Lord, not only would he be great unto the end of the earth, but this man shall be the peace. He will be the one that will bring peace. When the Assyrian shall come into our land, when he shall tread in our palaces, then shall we raise against him 7 shepherds and 8 principal men, and they shall waste the land of Assyria with the sword, and the land of Nimrod, and the entrances thereof. Thus shall he deliver us from the Assyrian, when he cometh into our land, when he treadeth within our borders. The Assyrian was to Israel one of the enemies of the north country. It was a northern enemy to Israel. It was coming technically from the east, but it had to come by the northern trade routes. So it was an attacker from the north. And we think it represents basically the same thing the armies of the north represent. It represents primarily the forces of Russia and its allies coming down against it. So when this happens, when this attack comes against Israel, when I gather against Israel all nations, as in the days of old, he said, then this man, this one whom you do not yet recognize, this one who you do not yet have confidence in, this one is the one who will bring the peace. This one who is feeding you, this one who has brought you to this position, this is the one that when you recognize him as your peace, he will come in and he will bring about the salvation. Oh, he won't do it alone. He could, but he won't. It says, you will raise up, not he, but you will raise up to assist seven shepherds and eight principal men, or your margins would say princes among men. Seven shepherds, we would suggest, is the complete, seven being the number of completeness, the complete church class, and eight being the number of a new beginning, the number of resurrection, the resurrected princes of old, the ancient worthies. But he says, you will raise them up. He doesn't say here that this great shepherd is going to raise them up. He says, and you will raise them up. Israel has one way. They have the ability to raise up even the dead. The same way that mankind will have throughout the kingdom to raise the dead. The power of prayer. Israel brought to her knees. Israel crying out for help. Israel asking for deliverance. Israel pleading mercy. Will have that prayer answered by not only the resurrection of the ancient worthies, but the face of the Lord turned toward them for deliverance, and even the forces of heaven, the spiritual church in the kingdom, fighting on their side. And when that happens, the invading forces will be as nothing. It will not be the force of Israel against them, but the Lord your God shall fight for you, even as he fought for you in the days of old. And that is what will bring this deliverance. What happens when the deliverance comes? He tells you. And the remnant of Jacob that comes through this trouble, in verse 7 he says, they are going to be in the midst of many people as a dew from the Lord, as showers upon the grass that tarrieth not for man, nor waiteth for the sons of men. So there is going to be the showers of blessing. There is going to be the word of the Lord coming from Jerusalem, spreading out among many nations. There is going to be the nation of Israel capped by its ancient worthies of old. You know how it says in Isaiah 1, he will restore thy judges as at the first. And thou, not the judges, but you with the judges restored, shall be called the holy city. Here is this unit of the remnant that has come through that shall be the shower of blessing upon many peoples. But there's another side to that coin, and that's the next verse. And that same remnant of Jacob will be among the Gentiles, in the midst of many peoples, as a lion among the beasts of the forest, as a young lion among the flocks of the sheep, who if he goes through, both treadeth down and teareth in pieces, and none can deliver. Because also through them will come the final destruction of Christendom. Jeremiah 51 goes into great detail in this. He says of Israel, they'll be my battle axe. With them will I break in pieces the nation. With them will I tear down mighty Babylon. A very direct command of the other side of that remnant, when the Lord uses them in the final deliverance. But before they can be used, before they are worthy for that deliverance, there has to come a great purgation first. Because he brings them into this experience of Jacob's trouble to get rid of that final pride. Zephaniah puts it, that you will say you're my holy mountain. And he said, I will deliver first the afflicted and the poor people. Not those of you who boast. He will save not the walls of Jerusalem, but the tents of Judah, the unarmed villages first, so that the walls of Jerusalem cannot magnify themselves against the Lord. He must first turn to those who have been properly exercised by the experience of this trouble. And that's what he talks about in Micah 5, 9 to 14. He goes into the purgation of Israel, and he purges them of eight different things that need purging. Thine hand shall be lifted up upon thine adversaries, and all thy enemies shall be cut off. But it shall come to pass in that day, saith the Lord, that I will cut off thy chariot, thy horses, out of the midst of thee. Not only will your adversaries be cut off, but you yourself will be cut. Your horses will be cut off. Your doctrines, your traditions of the elders that have become so sacrosanct and so hallowed, your doctrines that have carried through and have so blasphemed the true character and the true name of God in nominal Judaism as well as in nominal Christendom. And I'm going to destroy not only your horses, but I'm going to destroy your chariots. You're not going to bring your deliverances, your organizations, your, get the name now, their secret service organization that's been so powerful, and their military systems. All of this will be brought to naught, because it'll be my system that will bring the deliverance. This will have to be taken. I'm even going to cut off the cities of thy land. Your governmental institutions will fall. As Zechariah says, the city will be taken. The Israel of God's kingdom is not the Israel that is being governed today by the Lake Sykes of Sharon or Begin or whatever names you have there. That is not the Israel he's talking about. He's talking about a broken down people, a people who have been humbled, who are brought back to their land. I'm going to throw down your strongholds. All of these military alliances that you seek to make, all of your arms that you sought to establish yourself against the nations, that has to be removed because that's part of your pride. I will cut off your witchcrafts out of your hand. Perhaps you remember what it says in the Old Testament, that rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft. This rebelliousness that seeks to make your own gods, that rebelliousness must be removed. I'll take away your soothsayers, those who are your military strategists that plan the future and determine how to get around this and this and can tell you what's going to happen down the line and project it. All of these have to be removed from you. Your graven images also I cut off, and your standing images out of the midst of thee. Those things that you have put up to replace God in your sight, those things that you have made as a image of the invisible, you have to lose. You have to lose everything till you've only got left your knees. And when you're on the knees, then you can bring that power to bear. No more can you worship the work of your hands. Oh, and some of you, I'm going to pluck up your groves, the place where you worship other gods, the place where you become Christians, or the place you become socialists, or the place you become agnostics. Whatever gods you've worshipped, all of these groves have to be taken out. If this is the way, I'm going to destroy your cities. In this way, I'm going to bring it down to its very lowest depth before this deliverance. There has to be this total, almost annihilation, before there can be the retrieval of that faith class, that group that still has that remnant of faith. But I'm not only going to wreak vengeance upon you, verse 15, I will also execute vengeance in anger and in fury upon the heathen, such as they have not heard. Those nations that have come against you, these also will be destroyed. So let's summarize what we've seen in looking at the combination of the little gem of history from Genesis 35 and the prophecy that's built upon it in Micah 4 and 5. We have seen that there will come a time when the Lord will once again reverse the fortunes of Israel and bring them back to their position in their land. That in doing this, it will be at a time of three gatherings. There'll be a gathering of the church. This gathering of the church will be to establish the place where the law will go forth. It'll be made up of the ones who had been the halting, the lame, the cast outs of earlier days by the Jews. These will become the governmental city, the Ophel, and to them will belong the title of the first dominion. But on the other hand, there'll be a gathering of natural Israel. These will be the ones who will spread the word of the Lord. These are the ones who have been cast off at the first advent. These are the ones who will form in their final destiny the Tower of Edom, the Tower of the Flock. They will have a watchful place, and they will have the administration of the kingdom. But it will come through the birth pang of a gathering of all the nations against Jerusalem. A birth pang in which not only natural Israel, but spiritual Israel as well will be involved from a heavenly standpoint in defending Israel, in which the fortunes will finally turn, but not until there has been a final purging of all spirit of pride, of all spirit of doing it ourselves, but turning to the Lord and to His way, because it's only for natural Israel in the future, for spiritual Israel now, as we recognize our own nothingness, that we can be of any value to the Lord and His service.